Historia Canadiana is recorded on the unceded lands of the Kaniankaheka First Nation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana, the show where, for about 20 minutes before, Mac just rants about random students. But seriously, welcome to the show. We're a show where we talk about aspects of Canadian culture and history and, you know, how they inform one another. And today, boy, we've got a doozy. As we kind of alluded to last week, we're talking about the Indian Act today.
Woo!
I don't know if woo is the correct onomatopoeia for this case,
I think it's just good to actually talk about it, you know?
Yeah. And obviously, before we get started, we just like to thank our patrons, of course, Craig, Jessica, Elise, Tommy, James. And if you want to help support the show like these wonderful patrons, you can do so for as little as $1 a month and get access to early episodes. Or you can support at $3 a month and get a whole new show once a month called Pop Canada, which is run by Mac and is pretty much exactly as it sounds. Pop culture in Canada.
Woo!
There we go. That deserves a woo. But yeah, so if you want to support the show, help us reach our goal of 10 patrons. It's a small goal, but we're starting off small and, you know, help us climb the ladder.
From there, man.
Exactly. So, Indian Act. I guess I what the plan is today, because we can't go over the entire document. I don't know if you looked over it, Mac. We're not going to read the entire 30-page thing.
Oh, thank God. I don't. My eyes would burn.
But what I was kind of hoping to do today is talk about the context in which it emerged, right? And like why it was created in the first place, because it's not the first act of its kind to exist in Canada. But why do we kind of point to this one in particular? And also just talk about some of the most important points and what its general impact on the Canadian political and social landscape has been, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're mostly going to be basing ourselves, just given the chronology of our show, we're mostly going to be basing ourselves on the original version of the Indian Act in this case. But it has been amended many times since then, and including recently there have been, I haven't followed it much, but I think there's a bill that's either passed or trying to be passed in order to change some of its aspects, namely relating to women, right? Mm. Which is good, because as we'll see, the gender issue and bias in the Indian Act is a major part of why we just, it's a big yikes.
The whole document is one big, the name, the fact that this is what, I know it's the idea, like the issue, quotation marks, is that we would have to rewrite all the document everywhere that the document exists, but still.
Yeah.
Why is it still called the Indian Act?
Like, this has been a term that shouldn't have been used from, what, the 80s onward? Like, it was still used in the 70s and stuff like that a bit, but like...
But legitimate, like, how can the current government systems, not just, like, yes, Trudeau as well, especially, but all the parties that purport to be in favor of First Nations rights and using the term First Nations or Indigenous or Native Americans, not think about changing the motherfucking law that you wrote called the Indian Act.
Yeah.
Like, that just goes to show the tokenism of the whole system.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Like, that's a really interesting point, actually. The idea of tokenizing Indigenous populations is, I think, the crux of a lot of this act, and we'll get into it. But I think, like, the idea of what, of how it relates and how it understands Indigenous populations is just exactly what you're talking about, right? And you're pointing to the name in particular, but the entire act reads like that, right? Of just the boiling down of an entire population or an entire set of populations, right, to this one single thing under the auspices of the government of Canada, right? Yeah. So I guess to start off, right, what do you understand the Indian Act to be? Like, how would you sum it up, I guess, as an idea?
Boy. Besides systemic racism?
It is systemic racism. Yes, it is literally this at the purest
form. It's literally the thing. So when people say systemic racism does not exist in Canada...
In this case, it is literally a document that enforces a system of racism. Yes.
From what I understand, it was a document that was basically written up about how to try to integrate, read, assimilate First Nations groups and territories into Canada, right?
That's a major component of it. Yeah, that's the underlying idea. As we'll see, and this is, I think, kind of the segue into the context behind it, it was a way to bring together like a bunch of legislation that had been done about Indigenous populations or concerning Indigenous populations before Confederation. And by the point where the Indian Act came up in 1876, it was just consolidated into a series of rules that basically put Indigenous populations under control of the government of Canada unless they were so-called enfranchised and assimilated again, right? So that's very much the point. So every single rule in this thing is very much intended to push Indigenous populations towards being British subjects. So I guess to go back a bit, we have to go back to the 1850s, right? When a series of laws in Upper and Lower Canada basically said that certain, you know, traditionally indigenously owned lands were now vested into the crown, right? So they are now just part of the British private property, I guess.
The First Nations people?
Yes, right. So these kind of first acts were just saying like, this land, this belongs to the British now, right? That was basically it. It was the first treaties.
What land doesn't belong to the British?
In 1850, very little, apparently. but yeah, so basically these initial acts, which we'll get into, were extremely paternalistic, right? And they basically assumed that native populations required protection, right? They were saying, look, there's a lot of British land speculators and American and Canadian land speculators that are coming in, right? And we need to protect these Indigenous populations from these land speculators, from getting swindled by them, right? So we're doing a good thing by putting them under our tutelage, right?
This is what we call the white man's burden.
Oh, yes. I was going to bring it up at the end as kind of like a concluding remark, but yep, this entire document is the white man's burden of legislation. And what is the white man's burden for listeners who might not know?
The white man's burden is the idea / belief that due to white people, due to Europe more specifically, being so technologically advanced, it is our duty, or would be the duty of white and European people, to then take care of / help out / got re-command and tell people what to do.
Yeah.
That we see as inferior.
Yes.
Most often seen with the First Nations, Africa, parts of Asia, Middle East.
I think like the actual term came from, like, bringing it back to literariness, it came from Rudyard Kipling, right? A poem that he wrote in...
I believe so.
Right. So
it was the idea that white men had, like, they had seen the Charles Darwin theory of evolution, and that white men were more evolved, like socially and such. And then as the more evolved species, we had to help everybody out without realizing that we're all the same fucking species.
Yeah, so that's the burden, is we are burdened with the act of needing to civilize.
Burdened with greatness.
Yes,
like exactly. Superman. We are the supermen.
You just ruined that for me, but okay. Yep. Yeah, but that's exactly what it is. And like, you see this kind of rhetoric.
We're Spider-Man. With great power has come great responsibility.
But like, you laugh at all. And like, I don't kind of buy into this idea that a lot of superheroes are fascists. But like, when you hear a lot of like fascist people saying that type of stuff, right? That's very much a white man's burden type of thing. Right. The idea of like, oh, well, we're the supermen, right? Or however you want to see this, the overmen. And so we need to bring our purity everywhere. Right.
So the poem came out in 1899.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure as an idea that existed for a while before that.
Okay. Right. So regardless, right. Yeah. Probably as an idea, whether it was like articulated that way or not. You're right. A lot of the legislations that we're talking about in this case, just absolutely...
We can say it only got labeled in 1899. How about
perhaps,
that?
Perhaps. Right. Yeah. I did not look into this, so maybe, maybe not. But point is, it still is. Like, the Indian Act is a white man's burden type of thing.
Fucking white bull.
So Exactly. So these first two statutes, right, which I said were passed in 1850, the first was called an Act for the Better Protection of the Lands and Property of Indians, which was passed in Lower Canada, so Quebec. And it basically established a commissioner that held the indigenous lands, quote unquote, in trust, right, for the indigenous people. But they also had, this commissioner also had full power to do what he wished with that property. It's like, I'm keeping it for you, but also for your benefit, I'll be able to manage it as well. So you're like, yeah, that's going to go well. So that's the, again, we're not going to go into much detail here just for the sake of time, but that's the first of the acts. The next one happened a little bit later in the same year in Upper Canada. And God,
so this is, so the 1851, that's what gave us reserves, essentially.
Kind of, yeah. Although, as we were talking about, if you remember on the treaties and stuff like that, like there were treaties and stuff like that before the 1850s, but the first reserves, yeah, actually did pop up right around this time. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. But no, you get my meaning.
Yeah.
You get my meaning.
Oh, yeah. But no, you're absolutely right. It's right around this time that a formalized system of reservations would appear.
A formalized system to corral literal people in place.
Yep.
Fun.
Jesus. So the similarly named, right, an Act for the Better Protection of Indians in Upper Canada was passed in the same year. And with this act, it basically established that no one could deal with quote-unquote Indian lands unless they had the approval of the crown, right? So basically, again, just putting all the power in the hands of the British government, right?
Woo, British government!
And this is where you see the kind of seeds of modern Indigenous policy, right? Even though it's not quite the same thing. The act gave exemption to Indigenous populations from taxation, from judgment and seizure, as well as preventing the sale of liquor to Indigenous populations, right? So again, all of these things were kind of put into the limelight of, we need to protect these people from a British encroachment, right? Mm-hmm. But again, it's kind of hard not to see it with our modern lens of corralling them and putting them in like a separate part over there and kind of force them to live in a very specific set and then kind of bring them back into quote unquote proper society, right?
I don't know. I guess I know why it happened. I can see why it happened. And I don't know. Mm-hmm.
But again, like if we come back to our last episode, right? Think of the mentality that people had of Indigenous populations at the time.
That's true.
Right? It was an idea that they were going to go extinct, right? And so, and part of that was, again, their, to come back to this idea of white man's burden, like they realized that it, part was their fault, but they also saw it as like, oh, well, since they're going extinct, we might as well bring them into our own way of seeing the world. Right. And so a lot of the legislation that we're going to see today is very much informed by that idea. Right. So basically the government's main concern here was to protect Indigenous peoples and their lands from abuse only until such time as they became, quote, civil or assimilated. And that was like very clear in the actual text. Right. So that was like the groundwork, if you will. And a few years later, under the government, the joint government of MacDonald and Cartier, I believe, we get the so-called Gradual Civilization Act in 1857. So it basically specifies that, and again, there's a lot of interpretation here, quote, an adult male Indian of good character and free of debt would be eligible to remove himself from the protective care of the crown and acquire full citizenship in a process known as enfranchisement, right? And so here we get the first whiffs of what we called Indigenous or Aboriginal enfranchisement, right? Mm-hmm. Saying like, only men, by the way, they can't have any debt, which is very hard when you're, you know, making, you're going out of your way to make these populations poor, right? And of good character. What does good character mean?
Being English?
I guess. Wait, Christian.
This is the which one is this now? The 57?
Yeah, the Gradual Civilization Act. I guess it means to be British or like to act like a British person.
The language of this fucking document. I swear to God.
But like, it's written right in it. Gradual Civilization Act, right? What is civilization, right?
At this point, what the fuck is anything?
I know, but like, again, we're like, this whole thing is going to be an uncomfortable mess of saying like, yep, this happened.
But it's also, and here's the part that people don't seem to understand about why the Indian Act is so horrendous. Mm-hmm. And I think we've talked about it a bit before. But it's the fact that it removed them from having the ability to trade and therefore become self-sustaining, reliable. So we can try and like paint good intentions or whatever, you know, they want to help save them from extinction.
Yes.
No, they didn't. They just wanted control. If they really wanted to help, they would have given them what they would give to anybody they valued the same way. They would have given them trade negotiation. They would have given them tax exemption and the like. They would have given them differential treatment that way, you know, but yeah. Not to the same extent that they were negotiating with the US.
No, that's not true. That's true. I mean, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, trade sanctions and the like, you know, if you want to, it's the same as helping out local business.
Mm-hmm.
You give them protection for that. The government doesn't, right? It's like, here's the thing. What they're trying to do here is essentially they're trying to, if it was a local business, they'd be trying to say that the local business had to do dealings with them.
Yep.
And so you might think to yourself, that's a government contract. It's not. It's the government being your stand-in.
Yes.
Very big difference.
Absolutely.
They weren't allowing them to speak for themselves.
Absolutely. Or like they had to speak through a voice other than what they're used to, right?
They had to use a fucking mouthpiece.
Right. Right. So basically, so like I said, by the way,
also the fact that they would have to acquire full citizenship after the fact of proving mm-hmm. themselves a good character. They weren't citizens then.
Yes.
They were still fucking zoo animals at that point being forced to stay on the reserve.
Right. And so like once you, like you had to go through a few steps, you had to be educated, you had to be debt free, you had to have whatever good moral character. And that would allow you. When there
was probably half the population did not have good moral character, was in debt.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how does that even work, right?
How is anybody supposed to get themselves out of debt these days?
Exactly. And so this would basically let them, once you passed this quote unquote test, like you could actually apply for a land grant from the federal government. And then they would benefit from individual property rights, right? But they would also be expected to relinquish their treaty rights, right? So they became basically full-fledged British subjects. They had no other rights aside from those of British subjects, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, there has been, I think, some historical debate about this act in particular, about whether or not so-called civilization immediately meant assimilation. I think
civilization, assimilation, same thing.
To me, I don't find the argument particularly convincing of historians who say, no, it didn't necessarily mean assimilation, but hey, I'm just laying it out there that that's a debate, right?
Well, it's part of the issue that like you would be, it's the failure to recognize that they were a civilization.
Yeah.
You know, if you're saying they have to civilize, like yeah, they're already fucking civilized. They have their own thing.
No, but it's not acceptable. Again, white man's burden. There you go. That's the only argument you need in this case. It's bullshit, but there. And it was interesting because for listeners who don't know, I am currently taking a class on Indigenous literatures in Canada. And it's interesting because one of the students was bringing up in our discussion the other day about how a lot of this policy of enfranchisement and like quote unquote civilization, it was brought about by MacDonald and other prominent politicians because they saw what was happening in the States, which was mostly a kind of sweeping extermination type of thing and straight up war against Indigenous populations. And they realized they would be too costly to do something like that, right? And so that's where you get a lot of these differences between Canada and the US, is because Canada said, well, like war would be too costly and we don't have the budget for that. So we're going to like gradually starve them out and enfranchise them instead and put them in residential schools. And that'll be more cost efficient. It's the worst. Like I don't know. I just have nothing else to say about that except.
And this is how you know this is just racism, because they said we want to treat them and save them from extinction, mm-hmm. but only when it's cost efficient.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you can't. You really want to save people, the dollar doesn't matter then.
Well, it always matters, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So this 1857 act, the Gradual Civilization Act, would pretty much be the standard going into Confederation, right? And, you know, as the 1860s and 1870s rolled around, there were all kinds of other things that the Canadian government was dealing with in its infancy. Manitoba and British Columbia became provinces. They started making more and more treaties, what we talked about last time as the numbered treaties, right? They would start coming into effect. And so as the 1870s rolled around, it became a bit difficult to apply this act that was now 20 years old to more and more Indigenous populations, right? And especially now that there were all kinds of treaties that were negotiated with all kinds of different bands and nations. And so there we get the 1876 Indian Act, right? Which was an attempt to consolidate all of these previous legislations that I was bringing up, right? But the theme of, you know, assimilation and civilization would maintain and would be a major part of it.
I love the irony of that coming from, oh, it's been 20 years, the act's too, the law's too old, we have to change it. Meanwhile, we're still using the Indian Act of 1876.
I mean, it's been updated. It gets updated every dozen years or so.
Yeah, but let's not update the word Indian in a meaningful way.
No. And like, it was updated insofar as it was a way for people to, for the government to make sweeping generalizations about all these nations that they made treaties with. So like, basically screw the like individual treaty rights and all that. Let's make an overarching act that will kind of go
fuck
over
your individuality.
Nope.
That's all, for suckers.
Yeah. All Indigenous people are the same, obviously.
They all come from the same tribe in the same place, just like those fuckers from the United Kingdom. Ireland, Scotland, Wales. What is Wales? That's an animal. They're all the same white person. The same thought process, though.
I know. But it's like, this is, I will refer people back to like, Alexander Pope poem about that, about how like the English are, there is no such thing as the English. Right. And this was like 400 years before, like 300 years before any of what we're talking about. It was like, oh, the English are from, you know, are Roman and Anglo-Saxon and Germans. And, you know, let's not forget the slaves and stuff like that. So it's just like a bunch. It's a very satirical.
Bag.
Yeah. But I can't remember the name of the actual poem. I'll try to think of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so did you actually open up the link to the Indian Act?
I did.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
So this will be linked, by the way, in the description for anyone who wants to perhaps look at what we're reading. It's free as a PDF. And the Government of Canada has the most recent version up on their website as well, of course, because it's an official legislation. But the first, like, and most, I guess, salient thing that the act does is it basically attempts a clearer definition of quote-unquote Indians.
Well, right? Okay, I'm just reading this myself. The very first point.
Yeah.
This act shall be known and may be cited as the Indian Act 1876 and applied to all the provinces and to the Northwest Territories, including the territory of Keewatin.
Yes.
Does that mean it excludes the Yukon and Nunavut?
No, because that would have been the Northwest Territories at the
time. But it's not the Northwest Territories anymore. The Northwest Territories is its own thing.
That's where the updates come in.
Oh.
Yep.
I would have loved if, like, just by separating yourself, you could have just gotten away with it.
Oh, no? My God. That would have been so funny. Just like,
what a
screw
funny
you.
Loophole.
But, like, I think the territory of Keewatin is where Nunavut is now, if I remember correctly. Mm. I think that's, but I'm not sure, but I'm pretty, like, if when they say Keewatin, it was like the old name of what now is known as Nunavut.
Ah.
But, yeah. But yeah, that would have been like such a dick move, like such an F you.
Yo, what a fucking power play.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So actually, right from the beginning, it establishes, right, or at least attempts in 3.3, mm-hmm. right? Do you want to read some of like 3.3? So the term Indian means, quote, Do you want to read part of that? It's at the end of the first page.
The term Indian means, first, any male person of Indian blood reputed to belong to a particular band. Secondly, any child of such person. Thirdly, any woman who is or was lawfully married to such person.
Right. Any woman.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Was that amended later?
I think that's what's being amended now.
Right. Or, you know, can we just change it to the term First Nation means any person who comes to First Nation?
So herein lies the first kind of weird thing, right, about the Indian Act. I put it later in the notes if you wanted to look at it, but it's like, it's a specifically gendered act, right?
Yeah.
Like, quote unquote, Indians are men, right? And here you can talk infinitely about, like, of Indian blood, what does that mean, right? Mm-hmm. How do you determine that? Because, you know, DNA testing was not a thing in 1876. So it's like, that's a whole lot of interpretation in and of itself. But it's like, it's a very male-centric piece of legislation, right? So a woman marrying a native man who is considered to have Indian status will be considered, I think, Indian. But a woman who marries out, an indigenous woman who marries out of the band will lose her citizenship, or will lose her Indian status, right? And her children will therefore lose the Indian status.
So if a First Nations woman marries a white guy, she's no longer First Nations.
Exactly. She lost all treaty rights.
What if a man married a man? What if a white man married, or what if a First Nations man? Well, he'd still be First Nations.
Right. By the way, like, if you
would wanna, a white man become First Nations if he married under that law? Or is it just wives?
What do you mean? If, like, a white man married an indigenous woman?
No, if a white man married an indigenous man.
Like, in 1876, who thought of this? What are you saying?
I don't just theoretically speaking.
That, like, wasn't even a consideration. What are you even talking about?
As a thought.
It would have both been hung for public indecency.
Okay.
Probably. I don't know.
But if they didn't amend the law, and it still existed in that way today, which is, like, don't laugh and say that's not a real possibility.
No. You're right. I don't know. I really don't know. I would assume they maintain rights. I don't know what the modern, again, I kind of, I focused my research on the original version. I don't know what the modern, like, iteration of this would be.
Oh, boring.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Research not done properly. 6 out of 10.
I would assume that they, like, by the standards that we're reading here, because it's male-centric regardless, it would be, they would gain Indian stuff.
The male-centric gaze.
Yeah. So actually, if you want to look at, like, all the women's stuff, it's 0.3.3C2D. So, like, you have a whole section here on women marrying other than an Indian. Provided that any Indian woman marrying any other than an Indian or non-treaty Indian shall cease to be an Indian in any respect within the meaning of this act, except that she shall be entitled to share equally with the members of the band to which she formerly belonged in the annual and semi-annual distribution of their annuities, interest money, and rents. But this income may be commuted to her at any time at 10 years' purchase with the consent of the band. So there's kind of like a double-edged sword here going on. Bit of translation here because it's a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo. Like what we were saying, so women marrying out of indigenous people become enfranchised, right? They don't have their native rights anymore. But she still has rights to certain, she still has rights to certain payments, right? That a lot of bands negotiated in treaties, right? Mm-hmm. However, this can be removed by consent of the band, right? Someone who, like, if a band council decides, like, no, we don't give this woman her annuities anymore, that's it. So even within the actual internal structure of indigenous populations, this act goes over that and says, like, no, like, we're putting all of women's rights into other people's hands, right? They have no rights whatsoever.
The way it should be.
No, it's not. And you know it.
I know.
Yeah. It says, provided that any Indian woman marrying an Indian of any other band or a non-treaty Indian shall cease to be a member of the band to which she formerly belonged and become a member of the band or irregular band of which her husband is a member. So they're even determining which society this woman belongs in, like okay. when she marries an indigenous man.
Seems fake, but okay.
Yep, it really is.
I just, so many questions.
Little
time.
Like, just keep going, whatever. Ask away, I guess, because I don't know if there's like a really like good way to go about this.
To go about the, well, I know, again, we talked a bit about the schooling.
Yeah.
And that I do know a bit more about.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, you're still, at the time, we were dealing with who we were dealing with, wresting control of schools away from churches.
Yeah.
And the division between Protestant and Catholic school boards. That's basically how it used to go.
Yeah.
So I know this actually had a big part in that, in setting up systems where they basically let priests still continue to run the First Nation schools,
mm-hmm.
eventually paving the way for
residential
schools.
Yay.
One of the worst blights on Canada's history.
Yep. It's a national institution.
Yeah. Like, it's the horror show.
Yep. So...
And that's a great way. It's also a great exemplar of the Indian Act of its time.
Yeah.
Remove, separate, isolate, and then just fucking burn it.
Absolutely. So obviously, just because we're on the topic of women in this case, like in this case, it seems that they're only getting like 2-3 points in the entire thing. But, you know, over the course of the act's history, this has obviously had like a profound effect, right? Disrupted family relationships, removal of women from their homes and barred from active roles of governance that they might have had otherwise, right? Outside mm-hmm. of the Indian Act. It tended to produce and confirm negative stereotypes about Indigenous women. And, you know, over time, it made them very vulnerable to violence, both within and, you know, outside of their community. And one of the books that I used in researching this episode, which I recommend to any listeners, which is called Talking Back to the Indian Act. And it's a bunch of like critical readings and extra information about it. It says like, yeah, it doesn't take that much imagination to see how the Indian Act would contribute to the conditions in which we're in now, where a lot of Indigenous women have been murdered or gone missing in Canada, right? Almost 2,000 of them.
Well, again, if you don't talk about that, it's almost this idea that if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
If we don't talk about the problem, there's no problem.
There you go.
And that's the Canadian mindset in a nutshell, insofar as that no research done, no study done, yep. therefore there's no data to say that there's really a problem, or no official studies and like people have done studies and research, but not in an official like supervised capacity, if you know what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Therefore, there is no problem. All this data is circumspect.
Yep.
That's a word.
So, okay. Let's come back to like the actual definition of.
Well, it's also it's a great way to remove power in that you're removing the matriarchy.
Yep, absolutely. You're involved. You're removing the involvement of a whole half of the population.
Well, it's also just a whole half of the population that had a very important role.
Yeah.
And honest to God, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what really insulted the Europeans more than anything else, that they let women do stuff.
It might very well be.
A woman?
Yeah.
Performing tasks that a man should do? This insults my civilized propriety. Thank you very much.
What kind of... What?
What is this nonsense? This poppycock!
So, okay.
It's a disgrace. To Her Majesty the Queen.
In many ways,
performing things is a disgrace to Her Majesty.
But in many ways, it was, because what you saw in like the way that people talked about Indigenous populations in many ways, or Indigenous men, was that a lot of them were considered to be effeminate because they let women do certain things, right? And so, yeah, you're right on the ball on things like that, where it's like it offends delicate sensibilities.
Yeah, because sensibilities are delicate. People are assholes.
Yeah. So basically, in terms of defining, because again, we're going over certain things here. The act goes into like, repair of roads and costs and stuff like that. When I'm skipping over a lot of that because it's boring.
Skip it.
But basically, The long of the short of it is indigenous people, or Indians as they're known in this act, were relegated to basically being children, right? They had basically the same status as children under this act. You'll find throughout the fact that they cannot vote, right? Mm-hmm. They are wards of the state, right? We'll talk a little bit about that in more detail, but they were not allowed to drink alcohol, right, on their reservations. They could only be enfranchised right after like a 3 year after a 3 year probation or something like that, which
disgusting.
Yeah, it really is. So that's wonderful, really. Like if honestly, there's a way that you can sum this up, it's at the end of section 3 in the section terms, right? What's the last one? 3.12. So it's on page 3.
Oh boy, 3.12.
Just before
the term person means an individual other than an Indian, unless the context clearly requires another construction.
Boom. That should tell you all you need to know, I guess, about the Indian Act. The term person means an individual other than an Indian. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
We sign off right there. Fucking hell, folks.
Like honestly, at this point, it's just continuously an extension of that very idea.
This part was removed in the updates, right?
I certainly hope so. Let's look, guys, just for the fun of it. Let's see. This is the most recent version of it, as indicated on the Government of Canada website. Let's see. Interpretation, implication, definition. Let's see. It seems to have been. Yes, it seems to have been. Because there's a point here where Indian means a person who, pursuant to this act, is registered as an Indian or is entitled to be registered as an Indian.
Good.
Thank Christ. Yeah, I don't know when exactly that was removed, but yep. Thank everything that was. So in terms of actual governance, right?
They didn't have it.
On paper, they did, kind of.
On paper, their governance was the government.
Yes and no. Here, that's the thing, is that they did have state, like the state did exert authority over over Native communities, right? And, you know, Natives could be subjected or forced into certain things, including what you were bringing up earlier, right? Schools, religion, agriculture, etc., right? However, they were under the act, and you can look to sections 61 to 63 for more details on that. They were given certain says in their affairs, right? So reservations and all that were still officially vested in the crown. Mm-hmm. But they could be sold when a majority of male band members, for example, agreed to do so, right? And for example, chiefs and councils could provide for the maintenance of roads, bridges, public buildings, and make regulations for the suppression of certain inappropriate behavior. Like there was certain things that were allowed, but by and large, not really. Like it's a very surface level idea, right? Mm-hmm. Because basically, and again, this whole section is in 61 to 63, right? You know, so for example, 63, the chief or chiefs of any band in council may frame, subject to confirmation by the governor in council, rules and regulations for the following subjects: care of public health, observance of order and decorum, the repression of intemperance and profligacy. I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. The prevention of trespass, etc. But again, the key point here in this point, subject to the confirmation by the governor in council. So every decision that these councils had to make, right, had to go through basically an Indian agent, right, or what was called an Indian agent. So basically someone who was in charge of running that specific treaty or that specific band, right? They oversaw elections on the part of the Canadian government. They determined if the men who were elected, because it always had to be men, were fit to serve, and they had the right to remove them if they were deemed unfit, right? So while officially Indigenous populations never relinquished political sovereignty, at least at a local level, like they basically every single one of their decisions was regulated or subject to change by an Indian agent. So not really much of a decision there. Any thoughts on that, I guess?
On how they weren't really subject to any decision-making and how they were...
How they really didn't have that many decisions that they could make.
Folks, yes, it's been updated, but don't take that to mean that it's still hunky-dory now. Understand what an update means. An update means a change of language and a removal of certain parts, but not the dismantling of the overall spirit of the bill.
Thank you.
The overall spirit of the bill remains. It's like an update when you can update your computer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The overall spirit of Microsoft Windows is still the same. The overall spirit of the Indian Act is still the same. It's not going to be fixed with the update. It's going to be fixed when it gets burnt to the fucking ground into a tiny pile of ashes.
Yeah, this should go in the trash.
And just redone and rewritten.
Yep.
With actual advisement by First Nations people about what their problems and what they want should be.
So this is an interesting part. If you look at Section 61 here, under the part Councils and Chiefs, at the election, notice the language here and tell me what
you're
it
an election.
Of. At the election of a chief or chiefs, or the granting of any ordinary consent required of a band of Indians under this act, those entitled to vote at the council or meeting thereof shall be the male members of the band of the full age of 21 years, and the vote of a majority of such members at a council or meeting of the band summoned according to their rules and held in the presence of the superintendent general, so like an agent.
Superintendent.
Or an agent acting under his instructions, shall be sufficient to determine such election or grant such consent.
Mm.
Quick hint here. This is basically the same rules that apply to a lot of British subjects about who can vote at this time. 21-year-old men subject to specific rules of voting, right? Of majority voting. So yes, again, we're harping on this point, but I think like we need to make sure that this is well understood, right? You know, yes, they have self-governance in many ways, but it's on terms that did not necessarily apply to a lot of bands in many ways. We were talking about this 2 weeks ago, right? When we were saying that, you know, a lot of, you know, indigenous nations actually didn't necessarily have elections. Yes, they had chiefs, but, you know, chiefs were mostly there based on trust and based on the fact that they could get stuff done, right? Whereas now where the British are imposing their, you know, their own system of election and franchise, right? And, you know, and of course, this is only men. So women who had often played quite powerful roles in traditional forms of indigenous government were just completely shut out of the process, right? Much like the British system.
Mm-hmm.
And it just basically, while giving them certain rights, completely undermines their own traditional concepts of leadership, right? So, God damn it.
That fucking damn.
Yeah. So I do want to go on to sections 86, right?
Do it. What's section 86? What did they do?
We're talking here about enfranchisement.
Which page is this?
So this is page 26, 27. Yeah, more like 27.
It's 86 and 87?
Yeah, right. 20. Yeah, it's the points 86, 87. Yeah.
Okay, well... Whenever an Indian man or unmarried woman of the age of 21 years obtain the consent of the band of which he or she is a member, but they can't be a member unless they're not married.
Mm-hmm.
Like that literally doesn't work.
Yeah, but it's an Indian.
Who wrote that sentence?
Yeah. Wait, so hold on. An Indian man or unmarried woman, but she could be born within the band and she would have indigenous.
Age of 21 years, at that point, she is no longer the child of the Indian chosen, right? Because they're not children, they're adults.
Right. But if she wants to become enfranchised.
And if she's an unmarried woman and then she becomes enfranchised, doesn't that mean she has to get married?
I don't know. Maybe.
See why this is a problem? You see why how
I guess it does force her to become married in many ways.
Yes. See, this is why this shit's a problem. Look at how you write things, people. Take a second. Have a think if it makes sense, please.
Right.
Try and use your logic. Try and use your heads.
But again, like if you keep going, and whenever such Indian has been assigned by a band, by the band, a suitable allotment of land for that purpose, the local agent shall report such action to the band and the name of the applicant to the superintendent general, whereupon the said superintendent general, if satisfied that the proposed allotment of land is equitable, shall authorize some competent person, again, competent person is a very debatable topic here, to report whether the applicant is an Indian who, from the degree of civilization to which he or she has attained, big yikes there, and the character for integrity, morality, and sobriety, which he or she bears, appears to be qualified to become a proprietor of land in fee simple.
I love how they put she, knowing that they can't obtain land without being fucking married, just to fucking taunt them. Yep. Also, you're telling a group of people that they now own land when they haven't had the concept of land ownership for the past thousands of years.
Yes, but now you have to own land without because properly, we own like, the land.
Without properly explaining what the situation of land ownership is to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they...
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? It's like, you get to live on this land over there, unless you want to live on that land. Then you have to go through us.
No, it's not even that. It's congratulations, you own this land now. And they go, what the fuck is owning something?
By the 1850s, I'm sure, like, they under, like, 1870s, I'm sure they understand, like, the bullshit that is, but still.
Yo, land ownership and rental and renting stuff is such bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely. Welcome to our TED Talk on how property is nonsense.
The property market is nonsense. The housing market's a fucking deck of cards.
Always has been. Anyway, so...
Not even a house. It's just the flat deck, and they're just flipping to see what comes up.
Right. So after going, by the way, through all of these hoops that I just listed of having to be acknowledged by the band as someone who wants to be enfranchised, and then it goes through the superintendent general, and then they decide which land specifically this person
not
gets.
Not the tribe, the culture, the nation, the band.
Yes. Exactly.
It's like they're the fucking Doors or something.
Very selective language here. But so after you go through all of these hoops, then there's like a 3-year period where they have to wait, right? Base, or it can be longer if the superintendent general decides to see that, can you really, you know, manage this land properly? As in, can you like farm it properly? And can you not drink alcohol for 3 years? And can you basically do everything according to our standards? And then after such a time as we decide, then you can fully own this land. Every time I read something from this, it's garbage.
I get the computation and I get it's because of racism.
Mm-hmm.
Like this being, you know, an actual case of racism.
Yes. But, yes.
But
unequivocally.
Unequivocally, like actually racism, but it's also... God, mm-hmm. My brain hurts just because of how poorly written it is.
Yeah, but it's like it allows, I don't know, it's kind of bulletproof in many ways, where it's it for like the white person that's doing
it's
this.
It's bulletproof because it's a fucking cloud. How do you shoot a cloud?
Right, exactly. It's like you have so many hoops and stuff to go through, and basically the long of the short of it is you don't do anything unless the superintendent general decides it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's pretty much what it is. Or the agent decides it.
The agent decides that you have to then be a dickhead.
Yes. And anyway, the last one I wanted to bring up here, section, is about land. Because it's all about land, right? You were bringing up property and stuff like that. It's all about land, right?
Let's talk about land, baby. Let's talk about you and me. And we'll talk about all the bad things I will do to fuck you over.
No, but we're not going to talk about it. Anyway.
No, because we're Canada. We don't actually talk about our problems.
There you go.
We're like the mostly constipated relatives you have.
So you'll find most of the things relating to land in sections 4 to 10 under the reserves section. Mm-hmm. Here's a really good one, section 4. All reserves for Indians or for any band of Indians or a reserve subject to this act are held in trust for their benefit, shall be deemed to be reserved and held for the same purposes as before the passing of this act, but subject to its provisions. I love the use of the term in this case, be held in trust for their benefit. They can't, as in they're not able to dictate what happens on the reserves. And so for their own sake, we'll keep it in trust for them. And here's where like a lot of the previous acts kind of come back up and rear their ugly heads towards Yeah, towards what, you know, becomes the Indian Act. And basically this whole section here determines, right, the rights that, you know, natives have on their land.
Right.
Right. Specifically, actually, interestingly, number 10, because it was they were recent provinces, Manitoba and British Columbia and the Northwest Territories have a specific proviso, right? Yeah, which is kind of interesting. And part of that is because there was still like a significant indigenous population in these provinces and what they call in this very act half-breeds. So yeah, this applies, by the way, to the Métis as well. I should have perhaps Yay. Mentioned this, but this most certainly applies to that population. Right.
It all does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we move on from the Indian Act now? Can we say it's done just so we can...
Can we though?
No.
It's like, it's kind of interesting in a way, like because everything is so foundational to a lot of the way that, you know, I guess we can kind of lead towards a conclusion here because we've covered like most of the elements that we want to talk about here and just how shitty this thing is. But I guess like I don't agree, but I can kind of understand like how difficult it would be to dismantle something like this, right? Mm-hmm. Like short of giving indigenous populations full autonomy, which for a lot of people is inconceivable, right? Dismantling something that is so profoundly within the structure of the Canadian governance and Canadian society, like would be a headache, right? Especially like very quickly. That being said, they've had like 250 years to dismantle it and that's not being done. But I can see how much of a headache it would be. It's still bullshit, but yeah. Nice. I don't know. What do you not like? I think we're both in agreement here that
this is a god awful document.
That this is an awful document, and that ultimately it's up to the hands of Indigenous peoples to kind of determine how they want to move forward based on the limitations of this act, right?
Yes and no, because okay. That puts a lot of burden on them. It's also just as much on people like me and you.
I agree.
To recognize the faults of the document and continue to talk about and educate ourselves on the document. Mm-hmm. So that way we don't run into a situation and then call ourselves, I don't know, racist or something.
Yeah.
Or that way, so we don't decry it because the act is fine. Like it's on the burden of all of us to at the very least be educated. Yep. You don't have to be the lawyer who stands in front of and argues the case. You don't have to be the activist who is putting their life on the line, but you have to educate yourself, yep. folks. You have to know what's going on so you can be properly informed.
And there's some really like good ways to do this, by the way. At the University of Montreal, where I go, they actually run, I don't know, I think it's on hold for now, but like for a long time, they actually ran a reading session of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So like that was open for free to everyone to participate. And people just showed up, heard what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had to say, like, and learned about the history of why this thing was happening and why this whole god-awful mess is the way it is in the first place and what you can do to help. Right.
And I'm not saying that Canada yeah. is as bad as this, mm-hmm. but a well-educated population is the death of tyranny.
Yes.
A very famous quote. And like Canada is not tyranny. First mm-hmm. and foremost, I want to make that clear. Canada is not tyranny, but if we want to affect real change, it is up to us to be educated so that we can move past this. And you know what? For First Nations, it might really be a tyranny.
Yeah. I have no doubt that it would be. Right. I obviously don't want to speak for them, but like, I have no doubt that that would be the case. Right. So yeah, I agree with you. It would be, it's up to everyone in this case to kind of dismantle this slowly and yes. Like, or not really slowly, as quickly as needs be, because this
burn
is
it
nonsense.
Down, write a new one. God damn it. Don't just dismantle and update it.
Yeah.
So burn down the bricks of the old world so that they may become the foundation of the new.
Although you can make the argument, I forget off the top of my head, but, you know, can the master's tools be used to break down the master's house?
Yes. Know? A hammer's a hammer, man.
I know. It's like a famous quote that I can't remember.
That's like saying that a chicken is a person. Here with the deep Diogenes cuts. Was that the Diogenes?
Diogenes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Audrey Lorde, sorry. Yeah. Audre Lorde who said that, for the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. Perhaps that's a bit pessimistic from Lorde's part, but I think there's something to it in this case of like, you kind of have to think outside the box, I think, with a lot of legislation like this. Beyond, like, it's kind of like what you're saying, beyond just modifying it lightly every once in a while.
A light modification. Nothing special going on here.
Exactly. So, like, dismantle it. Fucking, ugh. So that actually would be an interesting project. Like, every once in a while on the show, just kind of read parts of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And just like record it and put it out there for people to freely have access to it.
Yeah. And like, I think we should do the same with the Indian Act, honestly. Just have it read out loud at places. Like,
yeah.
Honestly. You want an education. Like, that should be the education.
Yeah. That's something we could do, actually. We can have that as a side project of like read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like chapter by chapter, and then talk about it or something like that.
Yeah. Maybe. Let us know if you're interested in that.
Yeah. By the way, just to like catch us up to our like current chronology in the late 1800s. In terms of amendments, there would be some pretty soon to the Indian Act, although not in like a positive light as we're trying to do in modern times, because why would there be in the 19th century anything positive related to Indigenous populations done by the Government of Canada?
Fucking Government of Canada.
So, for example, in 1884, there would be an amendment that would be included to forbid the celebration of potlatch in British Columbia, so actively clamping down on certain ceremonies. Right. In 1895, this prohibition would be extended to something that we talked about last episode, right? The Sundance. No, you can't do that anymore. It's too quote unquote savage. And we're scared of it because
I'm about to throw my mouse.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I just had a wonky day today and I'm about to throw my mouse. This is just the chair on top. We need to call it here, else I'm gonna lose my shit.
Okay, final thing. A bit of hope. Because a lot of these clauses were very difficult to enforce, right? Especially when you're talking about something.
Yeah. It's like when they said that homeless people were going to get fined for not quarantining.
Like, how do you enforce that? Like, unless
Where are you going to fucking put them?
Yeah. It's like, how do you, like, to bring it back to the Indian Act, it's like, but unless you have an Indian agent who's like 100% of the time there, right, to ensure that no Sundance or potlatch is done. Right. That's not going to happen. So it was very difficult for...
Oi there, you moved your foot a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't think I'm doing the fucking Sundance, mate. I'll fuck you up.
But yeah, so it kind of points to the fact that like a lot of these assimilation processes were ultimately very difficult to enact or to encourage, but ultimately, you know, it did have a profound effect, right? As we've been kind of pointing to throughout.
That's one way of saying it.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to add on like this general overview of what the Indian Act was?
Like we said before, read it yourself, please. If you disagree with us, especially if you agree, disagree, I don't care. Just read the damn thing.
Yeah.
Like you can't make a solid argument either way without actually reading what is in the document.
That's true. That's true of anything, honestly.
That's my main advice always, I know, but it's out there. It's free, essentially.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I know it's a bit of a slog and just squint at it if you need to get through it. But if you wanted this to be an argument, you have to read it. Otherwise, don't get an opinion.
Right. I would agree with that. Like, this is just nonsense. But anyway.
And I mean, you don't get an opinion either way. You can't say it's good or bad unless you actually read it.
Yeah, for sure. If you don't know, if you don't know what you're talking about, why would you just do it?
If you don't know what you're talking about, keep your damn mouth shut.
There we go. I think we'll end it on that. And, you know, the Canadian government should have heeded those words. If you don't know what the fuck you're talking about, just stop.
So many people should.
Just don't. Just don't. There's a lot of things that we didn't cover in this episode, like the behind the scenes and all that. And there's a lot of, like, the book that I was talking about, talking back to the Indian Act, is kind of interesting because it features a lot of those extra documents, like minutes from the negotiations that took place in what was included in the Indian Act or not. And so I will like recommend it to people. I'm sure you can find a free version of it online or buy it yourself. It's really worth it. But yeah, can maybe put it up on our recommended reading page. But
yes.
It's
at the very least,
it's, I've been meaning to update that page, but yeah, it's really worth it. It shows really a lot of the thought process that went into this act,
You know what else is worth it?
Go for it.
Supporting us on Patreon, dropping a review, sending us an email, or supporting us through PayPal is to pay what you feel the show is worth, or using our affiliate links.
Yep. That's exactly that. So yeah, just do any of what Max said and, you know, make sure that the show remains.
Tell us you love us.
Yeah.
We need it. I'm lonely.
But I'm here for you.
Yeah, but you're just a voice on the other side of the screen.
We go see movies together once in a while and go out to supper.
That's true. I still have shirts to give you.
I know. So yeah, I think we'll pretty much leave it at that.
Otherwise I'm going to lose my shit too much. And this is just, I'm going to break my mic from too much screaming.
So we'll leave it at that. Thank you again for everyone for listening. And like, let us know what you would like to hear in the future.
Yeah. Right,
about certain things, whether it's Indigenous related or not.
Tell us if we said like something wrong or said something offensive.
Always. And that's like true regardless of, you know, episodes about Indigenous people or, you know, just in general. Yep. And yeah, over the next few episodes, we're going to keep going on, the way that Canada, you know, has expanded and, you know, becomes what it becomes in the 19th century. We're actually going to talk about soon. We're going to do another prime minister thing about the guy who, under who this act passed, Alexander Mackenzie.
I'm sorry, what did you say about me?
Yep, exactly.
The entire episode is going to be like that.
Yep, wonderful. But let's go. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.